From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. On the edition of this program, we'll discuss legal immigration to the United States. Much of the recent news about immigration has focused on an influx of migrants at the southern U.S. border with Mexico, and President Trump's request for money to expand a wall or barrier over several hundred miles. That was the main impetus for the federal government shutdown. The shutdown just ended, at least momentarily, but the debate over immigration to the United States continues. While the president has been accused of trying to curtail immigration, he recently indicated he wants to expand it in at least one area, bringing highly skilled candidates to the U.S. In a tweet, he wrote, H-1B holders in the United States can rest assured that changes are soon coming, which will bring both simplicity and certainty to your stay, including a potential path to citizenship. We want to encourage talented and highly skilled people to pursue career options in the U.S. Well, joining me now to talk about what the president meant and how changes to the H-1B visa program may affect businesses and potential employees is William R. Kerr, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. He's also the co-director of Harvard's Managing the Future of Work Initiative and the faculty chair of the Launching New Ventures Program for Executive Education. He's also written a book on the subject, The Gift of Global Talent, How Migration Shapes Business, Economy, and Society. Professor Kerr, thank you for being on the program.
Rebecca, thank you for having me.
And in the studio with me is VOA reporter Philip Alexio, the host of BizBeat on The Voice of America. Well, let me start by asking you to explain exactly what is an H-1B visa, how it differs from other visas, and what it's meant to accomplish.
Yeah, an H-1B visa is a temporary visa. So in kind of a weird twist of terms, it's what we call a non-immigrant visa, meaning that the holder does not have permanent rights in the United States. They are allowed to stay for 3 years with a renewal process for another 3 years. It is used primarily for intended for specialty occupations, which usually involves both a bachelor's degree or higher, along with some body of knowledge like accounting or coding or other sorts of specialized areas that the migrant brings.
And what kind of change is the president proposing?
Well, it's hard to always keep up with the changes that are afoot with the administration. I think there are at least three or four that have been in process over the last year that are often talked about. One is a change in the ordering of the lotteries that we use to allocate the visas. And let me come back and talk about why we have a lottery and so forth in a second here. Another is about requests for more information around the visas. And a third big area has been around the authorization of the spouses of H-1B workers to themselves, where it's what's called the H-4 authorization.
Is there any preference given to graduates of U.S. universities? I mean, some of the complaints have been they come here and then they're not allowed to stay after getting these, you know, terrific degrees from places like Harvard, for example.
Yes. Well, there is a preference given for people that have received master's degrees or higher from U.S. universities, but it's a small preference. So every year we have 85,000 new visas that are given to the private sector. 65,000 of those visas are in a general category where people from educations in the United States, outside the United States, bachelor's degree up to PhD can all compete for those slots. And then we have 20,000 that have been reserved for people that have earned a master's degree from a U.S. university. Now, surrounding that, last year we had over 190,000 applications for the visas in the first few days, and we've, in years before that, had over 200,000. So we have a scarcity of visas relative to the demand, and there's only a very slight preference that's given with those extra 20,000 for the master's degrees and higher from U.S. schools.
And Professor Kerr, so where are most of the visas coming from?
About 75% of visas in recent years have gone to people in computer-related science and engineering STEM-type occupations. A majority of the visas go to Indian foreign nationals. It's evenly split between people that are recruited off of U.S. campuses and also people that are recruited from abroad that have been working in India or in Paris or elsewhere around the world, and the United States, an employer in the United States wants to bring them to the country.
And so I guess I'm thinking, what is the reason that it seems that a lot of Indians tend to get them? Any particular reason?
Well, the sort of a broader backdrop of this is We have, for virtually all of our employment-based migration, what we call an employer-driven system. Sometimes you'll hear a points-driven system, and then you'll hear, as an alternative, an employer-driven system. In a points-driven system, which is, for example, used extensively by Canada as well as some other big immigrant-receiving countries, we try to take a migrant CV. Think about, you know, their education level, their fields of study, whether or not they can speak French or English or what other languages opportunities they have, and come up with a score. And it's an individual that's making an application to migrate to Canada. In the United States system, we entrust the employers to pick out who they want. It's a very simple point system in that if you get a job from an employer that's willing to sponsor you in the country and you're able to win the lottery, you'll get a visa. So it really, the next step down is to think about how employers are wanting to use the visas. And employers that have worked in tech fields have found this to be a very powerful lever. Some of that comes due to the deep degree of technical talent that exists outside of the United States and also coming through the U.S. universities that is attractive for them. There are other explanations or factors that build into this, like it's a lot easier to use a young computer programmer to drive the IT development process and to increasingly try to keep your IT workforce young and at the cutting edge with these types of visas than it would be in some of the other sectors where they could be potentially used.
Let me ask you, some visas are for spouses, some are for seasonal workers, and there's a variety of different visas for work related entrance into the United States. So how does the H-1B visa differ in that sense?
Well, the United States system is extraordinarily complex and one that has been kind of built upon itself over the years. Many people that come to the United States or immigrate to the United States come directly as permanent residents. About 75% or so of immigration to the United States is actually not for employment-based work. It's for what we call family reunification. So somebody is inside the United States. They would like to bring their spouse or their brother or sister or even a more extended family member to the country, and they're applying on behalf of this family-based reunification. That person may ultimately work in the United States as coming in, but it's not an employer-driven part. Within the employer-driven part, then we have a variety of classifications, again, that exist, with the H-1B being the largest. But there are other visa categories that are connected to intercompany transfer. So if you've worked for General Electric for a year in its European office, then you can transfer on what's called an L visa into the United States. And we've got a set of visas that are put aside for people that have just truly extraordinary and demonstrated ability, like a Nobel Prize or some other kind of very prestigious recognition. So there's a whole variety of ways that people are coming through, with H-1B being kind of like the workhorse model here.
Well, let me just ask you, what do you mean by a gift of global talent? Because, I mean, here in the United States, we would say we have great education system, as far as the higher education, certainly. So just playing devil's advocate, why would a country want to import talent that may be found in their own country?
Well, I think any long-term development strategy for a country needs to have both exceptional training for its own citizens and their children coming through, as well as also the capacity to bring in the best and brightest from around the world. If you look at the occupations where many of the immigrant talent are going to, the unemployment rate is very, very low in the United States. And it's not a very quick transition process to have other people be able to enter those places. And that's a reason why we want to be able to reach out to the world at large and bring people to the United States. Likewise, these things feed upon itself. One of the ways that America becomes most attractive to immigrant talent is through our education system. Many of the migrants that are ultimately going to take something like the H-1B visa are come here for either high school or for college and are then seeking to stay in the United States afterwards for work. So a broad-based development strategy includes both. Now, why do I call the book The Gift of Global Talent? I think one is just, let's go beyond the United States for a minute here. The capacity of taking people and putting them into the places where they can have their energies and their passions and their talents best trained and then best put to productive work is very powerful. It's not a zero-sum game, and an unfortunate piece of our world that's not going to go away anytime soon is that there is a lack of opportunity or very different forms of opportunity that exist across places. And so that connection is very powerful. And then when we go down to the United States in particular, the numbers are just extraordinary. If you look at our inventive workforce, so people that have been filing patents inside the United States, in 1975, about one out of every 12 inventors was an immigrant. Today, that number is about one out of every 3.5. And during this period, the United States has received about 57% of the inventors that have been migrating around the world have come to our country to do their work, which makes our businesses more competitive, provides new job opportunities, and so on. So that's the particular way that it has impacted our country, but it's also something that can be a gift to the world.
Well, what's interesting, because you bring up the patents, is I'm wondering, I mean, we do have a number of very famous entrepreneurs who have come here and started companies, particularly in Silicon Valley. So is it easier for them to actually get their product on the market in the United States than it is perhaps in other parts of the world?
I think there are two aspects. One, the market inside the United States is enormous, and that has been a long-term draw. You have 300-plus million people that are speaking a common language with no interstate barriers that go across countries. There's no country in the world that rivals the United States in terms of a domestic market that you can tap into. And the second part is we are more competitive. We're not, you know, there's always going to be some form of cronyism here or there, some form of kind of barriers that get set up. But relative to most other countries around the world, if you have a great product, you're going to be able to compete in ways that you can't in an environment where there's a very oligopoly kind of structure. There's a lot of family-owned businesses that control access to the supermarkets or the other key centers and so forth. The United States has a more open and competitive environment that way.
And if you have an H-1B visa, Professor, can you start your own company with one of those?
No, and this is actually a very big challenge for the U.S. immigration system. We do not have a robust setting or a robust visa category for immigrant entrepreneurs. We have categories that are servicing people that may want to bring a business to the country. And if you can invest $1 million in a business in the United States, you're guaranteed entry. It's called sometimes called the millionaire's visa for those reasons. But if you are a graduating MBA student or someone that's coming out of an undergraduate program in our country and you have a great idea, the visa system doesn't work for you. It's not something where just because you've raised funds and just because you're going to employ a couple of people in the country, you're able to establish a visa because we rely on employer-driven system. So we've given over to the companies the right to sponsor people, and that has been a gap. We had a ruling that was the immigrant entrepreneur rule that was under President Obama that was providing some short-term relief in this space. The Trump administration over the last couple years has ended that exception that was created. Admittedly, the Obama ruling was a Band-Aid over the situation, but we don't even have that Band-Aid anymore.
More of that in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Did you know our podcast is available for free download on iTunes? You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Faiz Faisal, a listener and Twitter fan in Pakistan. We'd like to hear from some of our other guests, so please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/PCUSA. Now back to our program. On H-1B visas in the United States, our guest is William Kerr, or Bill Kerr, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. And he's also written a book on the subject, The Gift of Global Talent, How Migration Shapes Business, Economy, and Society. My colleague Philip Alexio joins me in the studio. He's the host of BizBeat on The Voice of America, a video and radio report on economic trends. And I'm Rebecca Ward filling in for Carol Castiel. Well, just prior to interrupting with our shameless promotion, I just wanted to go back to the idea of entrepreneurs, because you mentioned that you can't really just come with an entrepreneur visa, so to speak. But if somebody is sponsored by an employer, and while he's employed with this employer, he comes up with an idea and no longer wants to work for the employer, what would he do to start his business under the H-1B visa? Is that even possible?
It's not possible. What would he or she do? They could try to do some stuff part-time, but it's not going to be a pathway to a formal legal business that they can receive money from and grow. They would have to start looking for other routes into the country or leave the country in order to get the business set up. And by other routes, I mean you could, for example, get married and achieve a green card through one of the other paths to permanent residency. But the H-1B visa does not allow for that. Another factor that's in here is that the H-1B is what we call a dual intent visa, meaning you can be both a temporary worker, but you can also have the company apply for a permanent residency on your behalf, so a green card. It makes it a very attractive program overall. And one of the sticking points of the H-1B system can be once an employer has started to make those applications for you, there are points in that process that can be very sticky. You're afraid to leave the employer or change positions or go and try to do something different during that period of time because that could mess up your permanent residency application with the country. So it's both the lack of opportunity of how you're going to move and then also some stickiness that can come if you're trying to get the green card.
I could see where that could be a bit of an issue for someone trying to gain permanent residency here, but also trying to advance their career so they can't really make a better move.
Yes. This has been a place where the system has adjusted back and forth a little bit over the last 15 years. And I say that in the context of a system that has been rather immovable on many other dimensions. It's what we think of as the portability of visas between firms. Let's go back again to why would we have some sort of tied relationship between the firm and the employee? Well, on one hand, we kind of like the firm to have a role in the migrant selection. Think about something like how creative a person is, or are they going to work well in teams, or they really have that skill set right now that's very desirable. But just like everything else, if the minute you were to hire that employee, the next person comes along and takes that employee, that could reduce the incentives to make those types of investments. You can see in some places like sports markets or labor, you have long-term contracts that we assign between the athlete and the firm to try to get around this, but that's not generally true for most occupations. So there needs to be some kind of attachment. But then you can get into some of the downsides of this attachment, which can come in the form of perhaps the worker doesn't get the promotions that he or she deserved, or their wages are suppressed relative to what they're really worth. So over the time, we've increasingly allowed for employees to be able to take their H-1B visa and rather quickly be able to move to another opportunity with it, other than during these green card kind of sticking points. During the most recent year, with the ending of premium processing, that actual transition process has become much more stuck. It's harder for people to make those moves now than before. And a number of immigrants and H-1B holders are rather frustrated when they have these great opportunities that they would like to go pursue with another firm in the country. But, you know, there's this mismatch between how quickly the visa will be processed and when that firm really wants to have them start work.
And there is some expense on the employer's part. So, both sides have skin in the game.
It's an employer-driven system. They file the paperwork. They are also going to pay the legal costs that are associated with it. Now, most likely some of that in many cases gets translated into some benefits for the employee or lower wages or something that kind of helps the firm make up for that. But it's a cost typically for the firm, much less if you think about recruiting from abroad, where you're sending a team of people over to one of the India schools in order to interview students. Those expenses can be quite substantial.
Now, for, again, playing devil's advocate, some of the complaints about the H-1B visa program is that it does depress wages for high-tech positions, especially places like Silicon Valley. Competing with someone coming from India, for example, where, what we would consider on the lower scale would be a very high salary for somebody coming over from India. How do you reconcile that? How do you keep American workers employed and happy and also bring in a new talent?
Sure. This has been an area that has been increasingly and substantially studied over the last decade or more. We've had a longer history of looking at immigration broadly, but this has been narrowing the focus on skilled immigration policies in particular. And while the example was given about Silicon Valley, one of the things we have learned is that fears of depressed salaries at a city level don't hold. If you're increasing the H-1B visas into an area like Silicon Valley, that's not going to depress the wages of the computer workers that are local in there compared to other peer cities. And there's some economic reasons behind that. We call this the talent cluster phenomenon, basically meaning that if you're creating a product like software development, you're selling to a global audience. It's not that you can't have 10 times, you know, as many firms inside the Silicon Valley area, and that necessarily result in some depression of the wages. The interesting place where we have seen more evidence of displacement is going back to why computers and why computer programming. And I mentioned a little bit earlier that this was a place where there's a lot of young talent available. And one of the things that we've seen is that the people that are most likely to be harmed or to have their careers kind of thrown off track by high-skilled immigration are actually older native workers, not somebody that looks like them. And that's a very different sort of framing from the way we traditionally thought about immigration, which is that if you brought in a 25-year-old Indian programmer, the most likely person to be displaced would be a 25-year-old American programmer. And instead, what we find is more likely to be like a 55-year-old American programmer. And you may ask, okay, so why is that? What's the mechanism there? And if you think about the potential wage savings that one can obtain from employing an H-1B worker compared to a similarly aged peer, we often think that's in the range of, say, 2%, 3%, 5%. Blow it up just a little bit. But 5% on an $85,000 or $100,000 a year salary is not enough savings to really drive a decision. Once you throw in all those legal costs we talked about, once you think about this war for talent that's out there in the world and kind of the desire to be able to compete effectively in these tech spaces. But now let me think about that 55-year-old programmer whose salary has been increasing for 30 years. And if it's compounding at 2% per year, 3%, then they might be paid double what the younger worker will be paid. And there you start to see maybe a much stronger sort of cost minimization logic that could play out at the firm. Throw in there that the young programmer may be willing to work all night and all weekend and have fewer family obligations and so forth. You could start to see why there's evidence that the employers can use high-skilled immigration policies to keep their workforces younger. And that's particularly true in some tech-enabled spaces where there's not that much returns to experience in the sector. So if you've been in computer programming for 30 years, you still have to learn the latest languages and you still have to be adapting to the latest architectures. And the role of accumulated wisdom is less in that sector than it would be in some other sectors. And so we talk about employers both using high-skilled immigration as ways of unlocking growth. That's the good case scenario. Get scarce skills, do innovation, build up a stronger, bigger company. And then there's, unfortunately, when it's being used for cost minimization, which is the discussion point we just had.
But, of course, that could also apply to just any younger worker, whether he's an American or whether he's somebody coming in on an H-1B visa.
Very true. And that's why when we see a firm hiring a bunch of young skilled immigrants, we tend to see them also hiring a bunch of young skilled natives. And the one group that's not being hired as much tends to be the older workers.
So are there age requirements for H-1Bs?
There's no age restrictions. Mm-hmm. Again, I go back to this is, in a wonderful way of saying it, flexible program. In another way of saying it, a crude program, et cetera, in that there are no requirements beyond just the basics of the education level bachelor's degree and that an employer wants to employ you.
And the employer will decide, and then I guess I would presume that they would take younger people.
That's exactly
primarily.
Right. And most H-1B visas are issued to younger workers.
Right.
But I think I love the way you phrase that, the employer will decide. When you have an employer-driven system, the thing that I kind of point to people is that you have outsourced the job of selecting skilled migration to a firm. And you have said, to Microsoft, to General Electric, to others, you tell us who you want to employ, and we will employ them up to, certain numbers and basic working conditions. That's a very powerful lever you put in the firm's hand. And again, there's reasons why you say, that might be a very good thing. You have a guaranteed job. You don't have this classic case of the nuclear physicist that had the PhD, that maxed out the point score because they knew French and everything else, but then is driving a taxi cab because there's not any need for nuclear physicists at this point. Employers are able to match those requirements better, but you also have this potential for downsides or for unintended consequences that come out of the programs because you've given a lot of power to the firm. And I would say more broadly, there's two very important actors in this process. The firm is the first, but the other one is the university. The university and the countless admissions officers all across America that are deciding on foreign students have an enormous impact on our future immigration for skilled work. Again, about half of the skilled immigration comes off of U.S. campuses, and those are decisions that are made 4 years earlier, 6 years earlier by an admissions officer to say, this is a person that we should bring to the University of Kansas for study.
And then when you bring in these H-1Bs and they're here for 3 years and then they can reapply for another 3 years, how many of these folks who are coming over here working and contributing end up coming back and staying into the country?
It's not a very easy thing for us to measure, but it's probably about half are staying for green cards. It fluctuates around at the moment with kind of the diminished sort of perspective of America and the views of many immigrants and the ending of some things like the H-4 authorization and some other issues like that. The numbers are going to be coming down, but across a span of time, about half are staying.
You mentioned education, and so there's been a lot of talk about Americans not paying enough attention to the STEM programs. And as we know, India is very into the STEM, so-called STEM programs, science and technology. Why are students in the United States, when they have all these great careers ahead of them, why are they not choosing these programs?
Well, many are choosing programs that will give them great careers in non-STEM fields in the United States, obviously. But we want to encourage natives to be equally proficient in the STEM-based work as well as non-STEM. And when you look towards the future, everybody's got to have some amount of STEM in their lives, starting in even the elementary or high schools and going forward. But why in particular for the H-1B policies and similar do we see STEM? Again, part of it goes back to the particular way that they're able to use the visa, but we have two countries, enormous, China and India, billion plus people, that have been unlocking migration over the last three, four decades. As they have become wealthier countries, that's given the capacity for families to be able to send their kids abroad. In those countries and settings, science, engineering, math, and so forth are very highly valued. And it's not just China, India, it would include Turkey and elsewhere. But these are places that have a lot of importance and prestige that are placed on these. They are skills and subject areas that transfer very well across countries. So if you thought about trying to come over and join the marketing department of a U.S. firm, English is a second language, not knowing the American consumer as well, and so forth, there are going to be strikes against you. But for this type of work, it's very portable set of skills. And that's just led to kind of this sort of snowballing effect. And then throw in there the role of U.S. universities that say, look, there's a very good market opportunity for us to have foreign students that are in STEM work at the master's level, at the undergraduate level, and so forth. We've seen over the last decade and a little bit more, even increases in that university role, especially state schools these days face budget shortfalls. And one of the ways that you can best close a budget gap is by bringing in out-of-state or foreign students. And if you think about this as being with a foreign student, you're getting both access to a very talented student as well as also somebody that's going to be paying a larger fare that's helping to fund in-state students, it becomes quite attractive for a university to say, that's one way for me to help make the budget numbers meet for the next few years.
Well, this is a great conversation. I really appreciate your time. Unfortunately, we have to end it there. Our thanks to William R. Kerr, Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, also the co-director of Harvard's Managing the Future of Work Initiative and faculty chair of the Launching New Ventures Program for Executive Education. He's also the author of a book on immigration called The Gift of Global Talent, How Migration Shapes Business, Economy, and Society.
Rebecca, Philip, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And thanks to Philip Alexio, VOA reporter and host of BizBeat. Our engineer is Cornelius Tenner. And I'm Rebecca Ward. Tune in again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.